You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Now to the discussion today. The adoption of this landmark convention, known to many as the Convention Concerning Decent Work for Domestic Workers, and a discussion about the immediate and long-term prospects for ratification and the implications that this has broadly. The panel, it's again, you'll hear more in a moment, it's a combination of views and perspectives that includes an international area of work, but very much so also brings us down to the local level and talks about what's going on and what can be done locally. As we all know, this is a very important milestone in the struggle for rights for one of the most vulnerable groups of migrant workers. It's a group that is also the focus of the migration work that we're doing here at the Open Society Foundations through our program. About our program, the International Migration Initiative, you also have a handout in the back that gives you more details about that. But now let me turn it over to Nisha so that she can set the stage and lead our conversation. Nisha Varia is a senior researcher with the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, and she serves as an investigator looking at the abuses against migrant workers in Asia and the Middle East. And again, that is one of the areas, regional areas of work for our program. So Nisha will serve not only as our moderator, but also we want to benefit from her very deep and wide experience on this topic. So let me turn it over to you, Nisha, and thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Maria Teresa, and to the other organizers for bringing us all together. And I want to particularly extend a very welcome to all of you for taking your time this afternoon and joining this conversation. And I think you will not be disappointed because we have some really amazing panelists. I have been lucky to work with our panelists over the past several years, and here you have some of the most amazing activists really on the front lines who have a lot of great, really concrete experiences and lessons from the organizing that they've been doing. So to my right, we have Priscilla Gonzalez. She is the executive director of Domestic Workers United, and they are a New York-based organization of nannies, housekeepers, and elder caregivers. I think many of you may have known about their campaign for a statewide Bill of Rights that was successful this year, and we'll definitely want to hear more about that. Previously, Priscilla has also been involved in issues on equity and justice in education and has led other successful campaigns, for example, on racial discrimination and elementary school admissions in her community. To my left, we have Luna Ranjit. And Luna is the co-founder and executive director of Adhikar, which is also based in New York, and organizes Nepali communities to promote human rights and social justice. She has over 10 years of experience in organizing, activism, and participatory action research in both the US and South Asia. And Luna and Adhikar are a member of the Coalition of Domestic Workers United, and she was present at the negotiations in Geneva for the ILO convention. And to my far left, we have Noor Abdul Rahman. And she, as Maria Teresa mentioned, is the vice president on the board of an NGO in Singapore called Transient Workers Count 2. It is one of only two NGOs working on these issues in Singapore. So we're hearing from one of the pioneers. And she has led the organization in helping to research and write some recent reports looking at the situation of domestic workers and other migrant workers in Singapore. And I think with that introduction, we can begin. What I wanted to do is just start off by giving a little bit of context. And instead of having a series of presentations, what we'll do is organize this as a series of questions and answers, and hopefully have this be a more interactive session. And we definitely want to leave plenty of time to make this interactive between the panelists and the audience. We look forward to your questions. So domestic workers, this is an issue that was once quite invisible and has been getting enormous visibility in recent years. The International Labor Organization estimates that there are anywhere between 50 million to 100 million domestic workers worldwide. Sometimes they constitute up to 10% of total employment. The vast majority of domestic workers are women and girls. And we see that despite the valuable services that domestic workers provide, there has been longstanding undervaluing of this work, an undervaluing of work that's associated with traditional gender roles of cooking and cleaning and caring. So about 40% of labor laws around the world exclude domestic workers completely. And aside from those 40%, there are even more laws that will exclude domestic workers partially or in some respects. And so this has a lot to do with, you know, how the work of women and girls has been seen. It is also, in many countries, a legacy of slavery in ways that domestic workers and farm workers have been excluded from labor protections. And it's also connected very much to gender roles in general and the lack of affordable childcare or flexible workplace policies. And so you have a very kind of complicated picture going on. A lot of organizing has been taking place at a local level, at a national level. But what has really been happening that's taken off in the past few years is a global movement for domestic workers' rights. And this started off about 3 or 4 years ago with a convening of various domestic workers activists and academics and others, also facilitated by one of the global trade unions, the Global Trade Union on Food Workers. And it was at that meeting in 2006 that there was a decision to pursue an international convention which would establish labor standards for this group of workers. And this is particularly important because not only have domestic workers sometimes been excluded from national labor laws, but there have been exclusions from some international protections as well. And one thing that I haven't quite got into, and I'll actually leave this to our panelists to talk about what the realities on the ground are, is that what we know is that a lot of this work that has gone on in the home, domestic workers are often isolated, and they don't have these legal protections. So some of the most common problems that they may face include very long working hours, no days off, non-payment of wages, sometimes for months and sometimes for years. Depending on the country where they're working in, restrictions on freedom of movement and taking a domestic worker's passport may be very pervasive practices. And all of these conditions also contribute to increasing the risk of other types of abuses, such as physical abuse, sexual abuse, trafficking into domestic servitude, forced labor. So this is an issue of extreme urgency, one that demands a lot of attention that it has not traditionally been receiving, but now we see that happening. I want to tell you a little bit about what happened with the convention and some of the main provisions, and then I will turn it over to our speakers. The process of the convention, this group of workers were able to get it on the agenda of the International Labor Organization, and there was a realization that this is something that is a fundamental to the work that the UN and the ILO have been doing, something that they should have done decades ago. There's a three-year process of a series of consultations between members of the ILO, and the ILO is fairly unique in having a tripartite process. So governments are members of the ILO. Trade unions representing workers are also members, and then the third constituency are employers. And all three of these constituencies have a vote. They're all at the table, and any new international treaty had to be negotiated among these three parties. So after the first year, there was a questionnaire sent around. People were asked about, what was going on in their country. Would they support having a legally binding convention or not? What should be in this convention if it is adopted? With that came a draft convention that the ILO produced. And there were a series of negotiations. The first in-person negotiations happened last June in 2010. In Geneva, and the final negotiation happened this June. And this was a really interesting series of negotiations. I think several things were happening. There were certain governments that emerged as strong advocates for domestic workers' rights. The United States was one of them, and I'll ask Priscilla and Luna to talk about how that happened. How did the U.S. become one of the foremost advocates in this global forum? How did they get a standing ovation when they made their opening plenary statement? Very strong leadership from South Africa, which was representing the group of African countries in the convention. Very strong leadership from several Latin American countries, particularly Brazil. Asian countries being fairly silent, and in many cases initially opposing the convention, but then supporting it in the last year when it was clear that there was an international consensus moving in that direction. The Gulf countries initially opposing the convention, but in the end supporting it. And in the end, there was an overwhelming vote in favor of the convention, and only eight countries abstained from voting, including Singapore, and we can ask Noor about that, and one country that voted against it, which was Swaziland. Along with having this convention adopted, alongside it, there was a lot of organizing. It was an organizing point for a lot of these groups and activists that had been working at the national level and at the regional level to come together and share experiences and share models and think about a global vision. And so the International Domestic Workers Network is one that really used the organizing around the convention to build a global movement. And so that's something that we can also explore today. I don't want to talk too much more now. I'll be jumping in from time to time. But what I want to start off with is to ask each of the three panelists to talk about the work that they've been doing on the ground and a context of the communities and the issues that they're working with and the major campaigns or aspects of your work. So I'll start with Priscilla.
Hello. Oh, great. Hi, everybody. How's everybody doing? Okay. Well, all right. Well, thank you so much for having us here today. Any opportunity that we have to talk about domestic worker organizing is always really exciting. So I guess I just, in answer to the question, and just briefly so that we can have a discussion, I wanted to just start off by talking about why we launched the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign in 2003. So Domestic Workers United, as Nisha said, is an organization of nannies, housekeepers, and elder caregivers that came together in 2000 to organize for power, respect, fair labor standards, and to help build a movement for change. And for the first couple of years, we focused very, very heavily on building a base because we believe that by having a base of organized workers, that's where our power is ultimately going to come from. And especially in an industry that's characterized by isolation, that the most important thing for us was to establish an organization that could serve as a vehicle to bring this workforce together and organize to change conditions. And so the first couple of years then, we focused a lot on individual casework. So supporting individual workers to bring cases of exploitation. Because in New York State, at the time, domestic workers were protected by minimum wage and in some cases overtime. And so workers could bring forward claims, legal claims for back wages. Back wages and unpaid wages. But we realized immediately that case by case by case, we were never going to fundamentally transform this industry, which is what we really needed to do. And we also realized in our organizing by going out into the parks and the playgrounds and talking directly with workers that the situation here was not a situation of just a few bad employers, but that this was really a systemic problem. And so in 2003, we held a convention in New York that was called the Having Your Say Convention, where over 200 domestic workers from across the downstate area gathered to answer this very basic question: what is it going to take for you to feel treated with dignity and respect on the job? And what emerged from that convention was a series of demands, everything from health insurance to a living wage to full coverage under overtime for all domestic workers, severance, notice of termination, paid holidays, sick days, vacation, all of these fundamental rights and benefits that most other workers in other sectors have enjoyed for decades since the 30s when our labor laws were enacted. And so that became the basis, the list of demands is what became the basis for our Bill of Rights campaign, which really is what gave force to the burgeoning movement and the really vibrant movement that we have now in the United States of domestic workers, literally from coast to coast. It became our flagship campaign for the national movement. So this campaign put forward all of these demands that called for recognition, respect, and rights. And it also, the campaign really served then as a vehicle to unify a dispersed workforce, a culturally, racially, and linguistically diverse workforce, because we had a common vision, this common vision of transforming and improving working conditions. And I'll just say briefly and then turn it over to the other panelists, what the arc of the campaign looked like. The first couple of years, you can imagine going up to Albany, there was a lot of knocking on doors that were closing in our face. We'd enter the room and a lot of legislators would cut us off at, oh, domestic. Well, I'm a strong supporter of domestic violence intervention and prevention. And we would say, no, we're actually talking about domestic workers, but there is actually domestic violence that domestic workers are facing, and we want to tell you what the day-to-day conditions are like. So there was a lot of education that we had to do of the legislators and of the broader public about domestic workers. What are the conditions? What's the history of exclusion? What are the dynamics in the employment relationship? What makes this sector so different from most other sectors? It's work that happens inside of the home, and in our society, we've never seen the home as someone's workplace, right? We've never seen it as a workplace. So the first couple of years was a lot of that work, and because we are a membership-led organization. We also really supported our members to lead the legislative visits and really share their stories and work on the develop the campaign strategy. But we realized that we couldn't do it all by ourselves, that we needed to have more voices in the mix, that given our small numbers, given how dispersed we were, given how marginalized we were, that we were going to need several other voices. So we, very early on in the campaign, established a partnership with employers. So an organization, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, became a partner with us in terms of organizing an Employers for Justice network, which became a critical voice all throughout the campaign. Our employers were coming forward and saying, we want to do the right thing, but we actually don't have any guidelines, and we don't have a place to go to have all these questions answered on how to provide, you know, a good, you know, what are fair terms of employment. So to answer all of those questions, so employers were a critical voice. The voice of the unions was also important, to be to show that workers across all sectors were united and had a stake in expanding labor protections for a workforce that had been historically denied those rights. So the next couple of years, then, were really focused on building a strong and diverse coalition that included, as I said, employers, unions, different community organizations, students. And then the last couple of years of the campaign were focused on escalating our tactics and really starting to demonstrate the power that we had built in the initial years. So that meant huge Albany days where we would bring 200, 300, 400 people at a time to have 80 or so legislative visits. One year we even got the former president of the now the former president of the AFL-CIO, the largest federation of unions in the United States, John Sweeney, to come up to Albany and lobby for the Bill of Rights. And the first two things that he said was, there are 10 million, I'm here representing 10 million workers across the country who stand with domestic workers to fight for this Bill of Rights. And I'm standing before you as the proud son of a domestic worker. His mom was a domestic worker for over 40 years. And that was really a lot of the power and the beauty of this campaign, is that we really structured it in such a way where people could connect to the struggle from every different, from any vantage point. Because the messages and the struggle was ultimately about dignity and respect and educating people about this history of exclusion that we were trying to reverse. So everyone had a role to play, and we believe very strongly that in any campaign and in any struggle for dignity and respect, there's no such thing as an unlikely ally. We all have a stake, and that was the tone and the intention and the feel of the campaign throughout. So I think just to close out, ultimately, you know, all of the persistence, this 6.5 year struggle of multiple visits to Albany, of workers sacrificing entire days of pay to go and fight for this bill, of a strong coalition of different voices advocating for this legislation, of linking up those individual cases that I had talked about earlier, those individual cases, linking them up and highlighting them within the campaign to make a clear argument and put a face to why the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights was the only solution to addressing this gross inequality that discrimination and exclusion that domestic workers had faced. All of the years of doing that work, we ultimately brought that power to bear in 2010, last year, when it was finally signed into law by Governor Patterson. So now, you know, over the last year, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, over the last year have been focused on implementation, on education and outreach and enforcement, and beginning to lay the groundwork for establishing fair labor standards beyond the minimum established by the law. So we're really excited about the convention that just passed and that we participated in through our National Domestic Workers Alliance. Really excited that this convention passed because we can actually use it as leverage as we expand the fight across the country and support coalitions across the country to launch similar initiatives as we did in New York. So,
thank you. And could you just briefly tell everyone what were the protections that were in the...
Yeah, so the Bill of Rights, the final version that was signed into law guarantees paid time off. It guarantees overtime at the regular rate of pay as opposed to minimum wage. And it guarantees protection against discrimination and harassment. And it also introduces the possibility of collective bargaining, so the possibility of domestic workers to unionize for the purposes of bargaining, of negotiating their terms of employment. So that's what we will. That last piece is the next fight that will be the next campaign that we'll be working on.
Thanks so much. Yep. This is definitely a campaign that many other groups around the world have taken a lot of inspiration from. So next, I want to ask Luna to tell us some more about the work of Adhikar and organizing domestic workers from Nepal.
So Adhikar comes to this work in a slightly different way because the campaign is older than the organization. We started in 2005. We're the only human rights and social justice organization in the country who's focusing on the emerging Nepali-speaking community. And so as a result, we work with different migrant workers, of which we started out providing services and doing individual casework as well. And the largest community that came to Adhikar was domestic workers, and slowly we started getting involved in the domestic workers campaign. And in many ways, we were fortunate that there was already an active campaign that we could join and learn from, and it has really been a very, very amazing experience. Like, we were a part of most of what Priscilla just talked about, from Albany visits to strategy sessions and nonstop actions, like some days, going on lobby visits, coming back and doing 24-hour vigils, and then going to do more meetings. We did all of that. That led to the success. But I think one of the important things about that, what I have really liked about the New York Domestic Worker campaign, was that it's been really inclusive and it's been built to be inclusive. Simple things, even if there was one worker who did not speak the dominant language of the meeting, we would provide an interpreter. And so that was that workers were really participating in meaningful ways and were not just there to be present there and just tick off. It was really, really led by domestic workers themselves. And then I think we've been really, we now have been able to take that work into the national level through our Caring Across Generations campaign and the convention as well. As Nisha mentioned earlier, I was had the privilege to be in Geneva when the historic day happened, and we got the convention, which was an amazing moment in the domestic worker organizing history. But more than just the convention itself, it's really amazing to see how the conversation's also changing, that there is lot more acceptance in the need to protect domestic workers' rights, that it has the countries or employers who were historically not in support of domestic workers' rights now are, even those when they did not vote for the convention, the few that did not vote for the convention would still say, phrase it as like, we understand the importance of domestic worker rights and domestic worker protection, but we just can't support this convention as it's written. We have problems with like a few things here and there rather than opposing it in a blanket. We got 396 votes in support as to 16 against it. So it's like almost 25-1 vote in our favor. And so this is a great step moving forward, but also it's even more than the convention itself, it's the international movement that's happening that's really the more significant aspect in my perspective.
And I'll definitely be asking you more about that organizing. But now we'll turn it over to Noor, and I wanted to ask you to give a little bit of context of domestic workers in Singapore, which people may not be familiar with, and a little bit more about the work of TWC too.
Thank you, Nisha. Thank you, Open Society, for having me here, and thank you everyone here for being here. I'll take you to Singapore, which is very far away from New York. Well, domestic workers is the reason how TWC2 started in the first place back in 2003. It was because of the tragedy involving a 19-year-old domestic worker from Indonesia who was basically physically abused by her employer, which then led to her death. So TWC2 is formed by a group of Singaporeans, so this is something different from these two organizations where they actually formed by the workers themselves, who were very concerned about the way domestic workers are being treated in our country. Just as a background, domestic workers have been part and parcel of life in Singapore. We have been very dependent on domestic workers, which I can safely say that most of them are actually migrant women who come to work from countries in the Southeast Asian region, predominantly Indonesia and the Philippines, as well as India, as well as Sri Lanka, as well as Myanmar. So currently we have about 200,000 migrant domestic workers in Singapore. And that works out to be 1 in 5 households in Singapore actually employing migrant domestic workers, and this is considered very, very, I think we are one of the highest in the world, if I'm not mistaken. So there's a very high dependence on migrant domestic workers. And migrant domestic workers live in with the employers, so this is a compulsory requirement of their work permit, which is the visa that entitles them to legally reside in the country. And they come to work on a 2-year contract, which is renewable up to maybe the age of 50, 60, I think, right? Which is, of course, dependent on their employment. So if an employer cancels their work permit, then they don't actually have any legal basis to be in Singapore, in which then they will be required to be repatriated. So what happened in the early years of us being established as an organization was our key objective was to increase the visibility of the experiences of these workers. Prior to that, there wasn't much grassroots movement about the experiences and the plight to increase their visibility and experiences and the plight to champion for the rights and better treatment of these workers. And so in the early days of our formation, we went on a major media advocacy program where we worked with the local media. We had a lot of volunteers coming from all walks of life, students, journalists, photojournalists, professionals, lawyers. We all worked together organizing exhibitions, organizing competitions in schools, you know, write essay competitions, for example, to get school children to talk about domestic workers, to get them to realize the work that they do and the importance of domestic workers to their families as well as to the Singapore economy. We have photo exhibitions which documents the lives of domestic workers at work as well as outside of work. The objective was to basically to humanize the domestic worker because there are a lot of negative stereotypes about who they are as people. There is a great concern among employers that if domestic workers were given the freedom of a regular weekly day off, that, you know, they would get into trouble, they would get involved in prostitution, they would have a boyfriend and get pregnant, which is not a problem, but in Singapore it's a problem because the work permit regulation demands that if a domestic worker falls pregnant, that she should be repatriated. So employers are concerned because that means inconvenience for them. So the photo exhibition was meant to basically show, you know, different portrayals of who the identity of a domestic worker. You know, we've come across domestic workers who actually volunteer during the day off, for example, or, you know, just socialize with their friends. So we wanted to humanize this who the domestic worker is. And then apart from that, we have also embarked on research projects to highlight the employment conditions. So basically, let me just give you a rough idea. On average, a domestic worker in Singapore work for about 14 hours per day. Most of them do not have access to a day off. The last statistics survey that we did indicates that only 12% of the employers that we surveyed reported giving their domestic workers a weekly day off. And 50% of the employer said that probably the domestic worker have a day off once a month. And if we are talking about a living condition, it means that this domestic worker spends 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, living in with their employers. Most domestic workers do that. Apart from that, the long hours of work, no access to a day off. Domestic workers who come across to Singapore usually use channels of recruitment. So they are recruited by labor recruiters in their countries of origin, in the Philippines or in Indonesia. And then they are then marketed to employment agencies in Singapore, who then market them to employers in Singapore. So this channel of recruitment also means that they are also responsible to pay for the fees that are incurred to come to travel from their country of origin to Singapore. And of course, labor recruiters in countries of origin, employment agencies in Singapore add on to those fees as well. So right now we have a situation whereby a domestic worker that comes across will be working for anything between 8 to 9 months, earning only a salary of $10 or $20 a month because the salary, a huge chunk of the salary is actually being deducted to pay back the loans that they have undertaken in order to afford to be able to come across for this employment opportunity in Singapore. So that's another issue, so the high recruitment fee. Another issue is, of course, given that they don't have access to a day off, there's a lot of issues of culture shock, communication issues between domestic workers and employers. Singapore is a multiracial society, very much like New York, not as diverse. Our four main racial groups are Malay, Chinese, Indian, and Eurasians. And so some of the domestic workers, they're not well-versed in English. Our language of operation is actually English. So there's a lot of communication problem with the employers, especially if it's actually the elderly employers who will speak in their native language and will not be able to communicate very well. And apart from that, you know, food, different cultures, different food expectations, and of course the lifestyle of the families of the employers and their families. So these are some of the examples of the problems and experiences that we have documented on the ground. So apart from actually in the beginning where we actually went on this publicity campaign to highlight some of these issues, we also currently, that was back in 2003. So just fast forward to now, our concern is not much has actually changed in terms of the employment conditions. Although I must say that there has been an opening up of the government as well as the people in terms of actually engaging in dialogue, in terms of wanting to improve the situation of domestic workers in Singapore. So we have been involved in a way in, with the ILO convention, but most of our advocacy efforts are basically focused locally. So right now, for domestic workers, what we are doing is actually the day off campaign. Because to us, having access to a day off is a basic right of a worker, but it is also a key for the domestic workers to be able to have free time, to actually also a key for the domestic, for us, for them to reach out to us and for us to reach out to them. Without a day off, we will not be able, we will never ever be able to launch an initiative like what Priscilla did with her organization, which is a great initiative. But, you know, given that most domestic workers in Singapore do not have a day off, so they are isolated, it's very difficult for us to embark on, some of these initiatives that have been outlined in terms of actually demanding for, better protection for them. So I think I will stop here and, you know, things will come out during question and answer. Thanks.
Thank you. So one of the first questions that I wanted to ask our panelists, you all have a copy of the convention which is available in the back, and I'll quickly run through some of the major protections that it includes. It, obliges governments to ensure that domestic workers enjoy the ILO fundamental principles, such as freedom of association, elimination of forced labor. It includes specific protections for children. Children are about 30% of domestic workers, and this is one of the exclusions, that they were not covered under minimum age laws, and even under international standards weren't necessarily covered under the minimum age standards. There are protections from abuse and violence, calls for fair terms of employment, and preferably in written contracts. There are specifically protections from migrants, which was one of the much more controversial discussions in among governments during these debates. It ensures domestic workers' freedom of movement, that they're not confined to the household and that they're able to keep their passports and identity documents. It calls for equal treatment with other workers, such as minimum wage coverage where it exists, hours of work, overtime pay. It calls for a safe and healthy work environment. And then there's a couple of provisions which can be applied progressively, but it calls for equal treatment with regard to Social Security, including maternity protection. It talks about oversight of recruitment agencies and bans the salary deductions, for example, which are taking place in Singapore. And finally, it calls for effective access to courts and accessible complaints mechanisms, for labor inspections. This was also one of the most controversial issues. Can you guarantee labor inspections of homes and penalties? So that's a very quick run through. But here is the question that I have for our panelists, is that the United States and Singapore are both countries that are among the least likely to ratify this convention anytime soon. Singapore was one of the eight countries that didn't support it, and while the United States did support it, they've made it pretty clear that they are not planning to ratify it anytime soon. So what does this mean for your work? How can you use the convention? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
I mean, this is a question we do get a lot, and it's great, but U.S. does not really have a good track record of ratifying conventions, so what's the point? And for us, it's like, it's both what's going to happen, but also how we can leverage the convention, but also what has come as a part of our work with the gearing towards the convention. I think one of the biggest thing that has come out is the international network and our work with the international work network, where we've had the opportunity to learn from each other. Again, New York Domestic Worker Bill of Rights campaign and the international campaign, like, you know, we got to learn from each other a lot because when we were doing research on the possibilities of collective bargaining, and Priscilla can speak more about that, but we got to learn from groups that had already long histories of organizing in much of Latin America, in South Africa, in some of the examples in some of the European countries, and try to figure out what works for us. And also when we were in Geneva, Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign, the video about the campaign success, we're watching it all the time and being inspired by it. And like, we were collecting stories, using some of our strategies to inform the international campaigning as well. And I think also, to be part of, as part of this work, we were able to deepen our work with AFL-CIO. AFL-CIO and leading to a partnership, a formal partnership earlier this year. And then AFL-CIO had one of our members, Juana Flores, as a part of the worker delegation, so she was a voting member. And also with the AFL-CIO's work, the reach in Department of Labor, we were able to reach, have more of a say with the Department of Labor as well. And then I guess like why the Department of State became, there was people, they were talking about how they were really surprised to see this like massive change in how U.S. governments spoke, started speaking about workers' rights. They were really not used to it, especially in the, you know, the previous 8 years, I guess. But then I think one of the reason is that the one of the things that have changed for better in the Obama administration has been the Department of Labor. One of the reasons being who the Secretary of the secretary is, that Hilda Solis is a daughter of domestic worker as well and has been very supportive of our work. So we have been able to work, build our work and have more of a reach within the Department of Labor, and then also use that to push for our better standards for domestic workers here and at our national level to around sleeping time, around like how you keep track of your hours, around live-in workers' conditions, because then we can now go back and say, like, well, you got standing ovation in Geneva. You said you championed for, you not only voted for it, you championed for these. Now, like, you have the obligation to really hold, act, not just speak, just also act on it. So we're better able to push for, put our demands forward. And also what, and the convention has also gotten a lot of our, it's mobilized our membership base as well. Like, people are really excited. Like what Domestic Workers Bill of Rights did for New York workers, it's doing it at a national level as well. To know, even, we know that it's not, I mean, even the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign, there's a lot of work that we need to do around implementation. Like, you know, a lot of what Sanur was talking about, what happens in Singapore is happening here also. Still, it still happens right here in New York also. But just to know that there is a protection, that there is a formal protection, and then recognition at international level, that's really helped us in reaching out to new members, to our, in our communities, to also get support not only from domestic workers but from others also, and then we can also use that as a leverage when we're negotiating with employers to say there is a new standard, international standard of protection. And so it's overall, although we know that ratification is not going to happen anytime soon, it's already done a lot of good to our movement.
Yeah, I just want to underscore Luna's examples because the adoption of this convention has created a lot of momentum and opened up a lot of opportunity for education of governments, local, state, and federal. In terms of the conditions that domestic workers face, and in terms of what's possible in terms of provisions for rights and benefits that domestic workers should receive. And it's also creating the building the momentum for us to lift up existing campaigns that we're advancing in the states. So, for example, we both mentioned the National Domestic Workers Alliance. This is an alliance that we helped to form in 2007, and with 11 or so organizations across the country, the National Alliance has now grown to over 33 member organizations in about 17 different cities across the country. With the passage of the New York Bill of Rights, there's now a California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign that was launched earlier this year, and that has moved pretty quickly through the legislature and is now in the Senate. And so the opportunity to be able to refer to international standards, to be able to refer to an international movement, to be able to draw, to expand the spotlight on domestic workers and really bring this workforce out of the shadows of slavery, out of the shadows of exclusion. All of that is creating just a lot of momentum, a lot of interest, and a lot of opportunities, as I said, to really educate and mobilize people around the rights of domestic workers who are caring for the most important elements in the lives of their employers, their children, their parents, their elders. They're keeping their homes safe and secure. So all of this, so these international developments, the state developments, all of that is building momentum. Massachusetts, Illinois, Maryland, and Washington State are all also getting ready to launch Bill of Rights campaigns. So we are we're moving ahead on the state front, and Luna also talked a lot about the work that we're doing with the Department of Labor. We have a regulatory agenda that we're moving. There are some things that we can pass in regulations that are that you don't have to go through a whole legislative process in Congress for, and that would make a significant impact in the lives of domestic workers sooner rather than later. So things like record keeping and sleeping time that Luna mentioned, that we have a regulatory agenda that we're trying to push with the DOL. So again, the adoption of the convention is giving us that opportunity to be able to push those, because those are similar demands that are in, that were adopted in the convention. So we can make that connection and use it as leverage to push the agenda. Oh, sorry, and just one more thing to add. Just lastly, the last thing is just want to highlight again what Luna mentioned about the relationship with the AFL-CIO. The fact that they opened up their delegation to include domestic workers was historic in and of itself, because domestic workers in this country don't have the right to unionize, which means that the AFL-CIO doesn't represent domestic workers, which means that there was this bold step that was taken to acknowledge we don't recognize domestic workers. Domestic workers need to be at the negotiation table to represent their own interests. So with Juana Flores, one of our members of the Alliance from California, being at the table, that partnership was lifted up as a model for the kinds of collaborations that we wanted to see in other countries. So workers being represented by the Worker Federation at the ILO. So really having that leadership of the workers at the table to determine their own fate in this convention. And that's certainly laying the groundwork for a lot more partnership and a stronger labor movement that's inclusive of workers that have been historically excluded from basic labor protections and that unions haven't been able to organize because in part because of that.
It was really first time that so many of the workers of the sector that was being discussed were actually present at the negotiating table at ILO. Although there is worker representation, historically that the workers being discussed have not had a voice there, so that was also really significant.
For the case of Singapore, I agree with Priscilla and Luna. I think it opens up opportunities for further advocacy in terms of advocating for better protection for domestic workers to be treated equally with other workers. I think Singapore is very concerned about its reputation in the international arena. So that gives us some kind of ammunition as well in our work. And I think being an ILO member country, our organization have a very close relationship with the regional ILO representative, so we also work together in terms of asserting, you know, pressure in that direction. What was I going to say? I think the Singapore government is very well aware of this, so they have also started to review local legislation. Their rationale for actually abstaining from supporting the adoption of this convention is that they will not be able to meet all the requirements that are in the convention. So, but I think they are on the way. I'm not sure how long it will take. It may take 10 years, 20 years, I'm not sure, but I hope it's not too long. But they are reviewing certain pieces of legislation in which they have included us in the consultation. So, for example, they have recently reviewed the Employment Agencies Act, which you know, served to address some of these problems with the high recruitment fee. They have changed a couple of sections of the Act to stipulate that employment agencies, the maximum fee that is allowed to be charged by employment agencies. So right now it's 1 month for a one-year contract and a maximum of 2 months for a two-year contract. However, we know that this problem actually also starts from the country of origin. So what we tell them is we want you guys to actually have a more concrete bilateral agreement to ensure that the process of recruitment, that we can eradicate this kind of exploitation from the process of recruitment. At the current moment, they are also reviewing the Employment of Foreign Manpower Act, which is a key legislation that governs the employment of migrant workers in Singapore in general. So migrant domestic workers is included in that. And they have invited different stakeholders to put in a submission of recommendations in which we have done so. So I'm not sure when they are. I think that they are projecting that they are actually going to revise they're going to have various rounds of consultations, and I think the new changes will probably be announced in 2012. They are also holding a lot of the Ministry of Manpower, which is like the Department of Labour here, a few rounds of consultation with the employers, with grassroots groups and things like that. But I think what is missing as well, which we have highlighted to them, is including the workers in this consultation, and it an area in which they have not done so. And they have noted that, and they say that they will, try to include workers in future consultation. On our part, we have embarked on a couple of consultations, especially pertaining to the day off. So we have organized a consultation with the workers, a workshop. It was small, but that's just the beginning. And to just give them, to get an idea of like what Priscilla's group did, what is it that they expect from a day off and why, in terms of the terms of a day off and things like that. So we gathered those information in terms of actually using it as advocacy. So the next step is we are also having a similar consultation with employers. And we hope to actually have the employers and the workers together. And we'll see how that will pan out. But definitely, I think the adoption, in terms of actually advocating with members of parliament, I think that has been rather slow. The problem in Singapore is that domestic workers' rights is equated with migrants' rights. It's because domestic workers are migrant workers in Singapore. So right now, especially coming off from the most recent general elections, the issue of concern among Singaporeans is actually the population of migrants in the country. We have 5 million. Singapore is a population of 5 million. One in three workers in the workforce are actually migrants. And so that has become a very politicized issue. So for members of parliament to actually bring this forward, it's going to be seen as not working with citizens. So politically, they may not want to actually bring this forward, although there are some sympathizers. There are a few sympathizers in parliament on this issue. But I would say that trying to go on that strategy would actually be a sort of a difficult barrier for us to overcome. All right, thank you.
So at this point, I'm going to save some time at the end for all of the panelists to say whatever else they might not have been able to in this conversation, but thought this would be a good time to go ahead and open up the conversation to those of you in the audience. And what I will suggest, if we have enough people to ask questions, is to take a couple of questions and then bring them to the panelists. So I'll give you some time. There you go.
Hi, my name is Lydia Edwards, and I am an organizing attorney from the Brazilian Immigrant Center. We've actually visited the DW in New York, and we're from Massachusetts and are actually not just launching, we've launched the campaign for a Bill of Rights there. So we're really excited and very inspired by this work. I came here because on Monday, the Brazilian Immigrant Center opened up the state's first domestic worker law and policy clinic. And I will be heading up that clinic, and so I definitely wanted to see how there could be real implementation of the convention on the ground right now. Three areas in which we're trying to implement and base build at the domestic worker policy or law and policy clinic is we're starting a mediation panel where the domestic workers will actually be doing the mediation between domestic workers and employers, and we'll be getting the workers trained to do that. We're also, as a lawyer, I'll be doing direct representations with the wage and hour issues and contract drafting to hopefully make sure that there's a lot of this oral back and forth that's actually put down in contracts. And then we also are creating a manual, a statewide manual. We're working with Northeastern Law School to actually outline the law to make it easily accessible by employers and domestic workers, because we learned from you guys that if the employers are there at the beginning, it's very key. So in those three areas, and I'm wondering if you guys have had experience with them, mediation panel or with the manual or legal representation, I'm seeing that the convention could be immediately implemented with helping the contract drafting. It's as a reference with the mediation panel, with at least being able to give references to certain rights or certain certain conditions that might be actually negotiated between the employer and the employee, and of course the manual. So if you have any experience in those areas, and thank you so much for your incredible work. It's inspiring, obviously, because we're right behind you and following a lot in your steps. So thank you.
Yeah, that sounds really great, the mediation panel, particularly because the I mentioned earlier that one of the provisions in the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights was to assess the feasibility of collective bargaining for domestic workers. So the Department of Labor in particular in the state of New York was mandated to make that assessment. So we got ahead of the curve and did a survey of our members went out and did a participatory research project to assess how negotiation actually happens in our industry and try to capture as much as possible the level of written versus oral agreements and certainly the level of broken promises and promises that are upheld. And also, you know, as part of that, wanted to show the continued vulnerability of workers beyond even with a minimum established by the law, and that over the next couple of years, we want to be experimenting with the collective negotiation process. So, how do we organize to build power and raise standards beyond the minimum. So we are going to be also experimenting with some kind of a mediation panel. The way I'd be really interested to also hear from you all what you're planning, because what we're looking into is neighborhood-based, concentrated, neighborhood-based negotiations for standard agreements. So try to promote a standard for a geographic area that could then be lifted up as a template for other areas across the state. And the idea behind this is really to see how we can take the negotiation process out of these individual arrangements that end up varying from household to household. We want to really standardize a fair package for workers and for employers to also be able to follow that and then be able to go back to the legislature and make recommendations for how collective bargaining needs to be amended to really address the particularities of our industry.
Other work that you're doing, I think direct representation, we don't have an attorney on staff, but we work with a lot of other pro bono lawyers and other community legal services to provide mostly wage hour, unpaid wages, and overtime cases. And we haven't processed a lot of them, but what we have seen is just to have that service has made a lot of our members able to stand up for themselves and negotiate and say, if you don't give pay me, or if I don't get this, I am going to complain. Just having that support, and then it's like having the support of other workers and hearing about people who have done it has really helped lift the standards up quite a bit. And in some extreme cases, we've had fielded calls when they were having an argument and the worker called us and the employer is like, you can do whatever you want, I'm not gonna pay you. And I've actually heard those conversations while it's happening, and the worker called us and like complained, and at the end of that conversation they got paid. And you know, we are a small organization, of course, don't have capacity to take on all the cases of all the unpaid wages cases. So our hope is to lift up the standards so that we don't have to deal with these. And we're slowly starting to see it happen.
Well, okay, I think that's an idea that's actually, you know, well advanced for the case of Singapore. We do have a direct services arm, which actually operates a toll-free helpline for migrant workers, and some of the volunteers of this helpline are actually migrant workers themselves. So we do work with a couple of small groups of migrant workers. One group is called the Indonesian Family Network, and the other one is the Filipino Family Network. So these are basically a group of women with maybe about 30 to 40 members, strength in terms of membership, but they have gotten together, and we felt that it's good to give them support because they are the ones who are organizing things for themselves. So some of them have expressed interest in terms of actually volunteering as counselors. So we give them necessary training, and some of them are actually picking up some of these helpline calls, and especially in cases where the domestic workers just need someone to talk to. So it's issues of like prolonged counseling, not sort of intermediate intervention. So they have actually taken on some of these roles. I think with us, the problem is also the changing of the mindset of the local population on this issue. Just to give you an example, I mean, Nisha mentioned that we are one of two groups in Singapore who are actually doing something for migrant workers, migrant domestic workers included. But there are also other, I would say that we identify ourselves as advocacy groups. There are other organizations which are basically really just based organizations that organize, you know, skills upgrading classes and other social activities and things like that. But these organizations steer clear from advocacy. They do not want to be associated with actually trying to change laws, trying to champion rights or anything like that. And we have had you know, many meetings with these organizations. And even when during consultation that is organized by the Ministry of Manpower, which is the Department of Labor, there are various views expressed by leaders of such organizations pertaining to the day off. Not everybody agrees that day off should actually be legislated. So that's actually quite surprising. And this is, I'm citing this example to just give you an idea about, you know, the mindset of the local population towards what sort of rights that domestic workers, you know, deserve and should have. So this is just an example.
And I'll just add, a lot of the work that Human Rights Watch has done has mostly been across the Middle East and Asia, and I definitely see some direct applicability of using the convention, which, for example, has very clear provisions of what should be in a contract, because it was amazing advancement in Kuwait and the UAE when they introduced a standard contract, but then you looked at it, and it was very vague. I mean, it really didn't improve the situation that much, and if you look at the convention, they have some very clear guidelines. But in those contexts, the issue of mediation is one that in those contexts, we've actually really tried to steer away from. There is such a deep power imbalance between a domestic worker and the employer that when you get into a context of mediation, it's not an even playing field, and almost all of the negotiated outcomes favor the employer, because in those cases, the employer is the immigration sponsor of the domestic worker. And so in those cases, what we have really been focusing on is, instead of mediation, have some very clear standards under the law and have tribunals which can process cases quickly and fairly and have translation, but have a very clear, you know, overall standard instead of individually negotiated settlements.
So I had a question relating to the Department of Labor. I mean, it's a pity that the United States won't ratify, but we're having enough problems as it is enforcing the laws that are already on the books. And so I wondered if you could comment on enforcement of existing wage and hour rules by the Department of Labor, because it shouldn't be the private bar that has to do that. It should be the Department of Labor. And then secondly, I represent domestic workers as a pro bono attorney. And one of the things that I run into constantly, particularly when the defendant is an attorney who has abused the domestic worker, they turn to the regulations and they say, I'm permitted to take deductions for all of the housing and all of the food and all of the expenses. And so I'm wondering if those regulations are one of the things that you're tackling. I've even had defendants say at the end of the day, I've done the math and you owe me money in a non-payment case.
So, in our regulatory agenda with the Department of Labor, the cost for food and lodging is definitely on it. There's five key things that we're trying to push, and we can certainly get you that information. And that's at the federal level. At the state level, in terms of enforcement, we have been working closely with the Department of Labor. They consulted with us heavily on outreach materials and where to distribute these materials, where to reach employers and domestic workers, what languages are represented here in the state of New York. And then also we're developing some recommendations for them for both administrative and regulatory reforms here at the state level. So things around facilitating the claims process. The New York DOL is prioritizing any violations of the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, at least for the next couple of years, because it's a new law. So there has been commitment from the leadership to really see how to enforce this law, because the reality is that there isn't a lot of experience with the domestic work industry. So we were brought in to educate all of their investigators across the state, to give them a sense of what the industry dynamics are, what could be, usual evasion tactics on the part of employers, what are some of the trends that we see in the industry, and things like that, so they could have a better understanding and grasp and be prepared for what would be, what are some of the claims that could get brought forward. Also, because there's been the legislation left some openings to allow the Department of Labor to issue further guidelines. So, for example, around paid time off, the DOL needed to issue guidelines on how to prorate that for part-time workers, for example. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done, and we've been pretty lucky in terms of having receptive leadership within the state DOL, and as Luna mentioned, also within the federal DOL. So there's a lot of possibility there in the short term to really advance a lot of things that could make a difference outside of a legislative process. Yeah.
One thing that comes up that I wanted to ask about is, we can talk about legal reforms, but there's so much about this that involves social attitudes and public opinion. How are you all going about challenging that?
I'll start. What we've done is we have, the Day Off campaign is basically ongoing, but we also accept invitations from educational institutions to give talks to students, to school children, and I think among the student body, I think from high school to tertiary institutes, there is a great interest in this issue. A lot of the students are actually doing some work for their, projects and things like that. So we harness this opportunity in terms of actually using it to create awareness about, the issues that we advocate for. Then we also use the social media a lot. We have, a Facebook, we have a blog. And lately, as part of the Day Off campaign, a couple of our volunteers actually started a Facebook that It's called Why We Want a Day Off. So from this Facebook, it's actually postings by domestic workers. So we mobilize the domestic workers who are working with us to communicate with their fellow domestic workers who have no access to the internet to SMS their messages to us as to why they want a day off. You know, why a day off is important, and then they also put this up in the Facebook itself. So which is great, because and this Facebook is open to the public, and we can also use it in terms of where we are dialoguing with the government. We also work. The social media in Singapore has taken an interesting turn. Politics in Singapore is kind of opening up a little bit. So there's a group of the sort of the younger population who have started social media blogs, which we work together with, and they have covered a lot of migrant worker story, domestic worker story, and also our activities, our initiatives and things like that. So we use those sort of platforms as well. But I would also like to mention that there is some limitations that we face in terms of advocacy. So just to give you an example, for last year's Labor Day, which we celebrate on the 1st of May, we wanted to distribute flyers with information on the ILO treaty, actually, and also other information about other groups of migrant workers in Singapore. So our idea was to go around in these open trucks, because that's the way migrant workers are actually transported in Singapore, which, we are against, but just to make that statement, and then distribute these flyers. But our permit to do that was turned down by the police, and they basically told us that, oh yeah, you can distribute the flyers, but you can't wear any T-shirts, or the flyers cannot have any advocacy message, or you can't wear T-shirts with advocacy message and things like that. So, despite telling you that, the government is opening up, but at the same time, there's also, sometimes it's like a tango. It's like, two steps backward, three steps, So it's, I guess it's up to advocacy groups to just continue pushing these boundaries. We never know where the boundaries are. But if we don't push them, we will never get ahead of it. So, but these are some of the tools. And at the same time, we are continuing with research because with research we have documentation of cases, surveys and things like that, which we use when we dialogue with the Ministry of Manpower, as well as we feed this information to international organizations like the ILO. We have made submissions to the Universal Periodic Review. We have made submissions to the CEDAW Review and things like that. So we use these tools in terms of advocating. And there's going to be a workshop with employers that's coming up. So I hope we get we get some response from there. So I'm not sure how many people are going to turn up. So but it's a start. Yeah.
I think the public opinion is probably changing. That has been the harder work than the, in spite of all the challenges in legislative advocacy, the public opinion part has been the harder work, especially from Adhikar's perspective. We were dealing with it at multiple levels. One was within the Nepali community, where when we first started talking about domestic workers' bill of rights, we literally got hate mail. We were like, why are you talking, bringing our women down by calling them domestic workers? They were educated in Nepal, they just happen to be doing this work. And we're like, exactly our point, it's the system that doesn't recognize them, and they're doing domestic work. And what we're saying is that domestic work is also work, and it is a profession. It is a profession that makes all other work possible and needs to be respected. There was a lot of complicated challenge in getting that message across, but the good thing that did come out of that hate mail period was that our domestic worker leaders really stepped up, and they said, we don't take this sitting down. I am a domestic worker, I am proud of it, I work 6 days a week, and on seventh day, I take my time off to help other domestic workers. I come to Adhikar and help other domestic workers at Adhikar, and I am proud of it. And they started really speaking about it in public, helping other domestic workers to also claim that identity, because a lot of times in what we've seen with Nepali domestic workers is like there's a lot of downward mobility, not just with domestic workers. Nepali migrants in general in US have faced a lot of downward mobility. They have mostly educated professionals back home who have now been forced to do low-wage jobs, like really long hours, back-breaking work, and they're not proud of what they're having to do. And so there was a lot of resistance in claiming that identity, but over, like through our work with the Bill of Rights campaign, through a lot of educational work, we've been able to overcome that. And actually, I see that New York Women's Foundation at the, you know, our representative each year at the New York Women's Foundation breakfast, our representatives have been domestic worker leaders. And so that has helped really put it out in our community that we really value all work, and we've done conferences around it. Each International Women's Day, we have a conference where we've invited a cross-section of Nepali women, people who work at the UN and domestic workers and students, and have them all be on the same panel and saying, like, we value all of your work equal, all of your experience equally. And so slowly it's changing, and now in the community, in the media also is coming around and starting to recognize the value of our work. And then we still have a lot more work to do with the employers, because oftentimes our sisters work with employers from South Asia because of language issues, because of cultural food issues, like they prefer to work with South Asian employers, and the mindset of the domestic workers as servants is carried over here as well. And so it's like, you are a domestic worker, you should be grateful that if they bring them here, that's like, you should be grateful that you even got to come to the US. You should be grateful you have a job. You should be grateful, like, do you know how much this money is in Nepali rupees? And so we're slowly changing it, and having these laws help us in advocate, but that is a much longer battle.
I'll just add, bring up some examples from Lebanon, which I think are really interesting in terms of, you know, this is a place where the freedom of movement of domestic workers is still really restricted, and how to go about challenging some of these public attitudes and opinions. And they have just really taken off with the social media. So there's a very active Facebook group, and there's actually Facebook groups for domestic workers' rights in Kuwait as well. This is starting to happen in more places. This group put together this video, which really turned on its head some stereotypes. So there's, in Lebanon, a lot of stereotypes about Ethiopian domestic workers and Sri Lankan domestic workers. And they had a video where they made the Sri Lankans and the Ethiopians the employers, and they had a Lebanese woman be the domestic worker. And this video caught on fire. I mean, it was circulated, I think, around the entire country, and just, you know, sparked such debate, just that idea of, like, what would happen if we switched roles? And so I thought that one was really interesting. I'm mindful of the time, and so I just wanted to ask whether there are any further questions from the audience before we have some closing statements. Be shy. Let me just repeat that question for the recording, which is asking Priscilla for her response about working with employers and soliciting their involvement or not in, in different cases.
Yeah, so I wanted to say a few things. One is just to mark how far we've come in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, the only stories that you ever saw in the media were stories about the nanny who did something to the child that they were taking care of. 10 years later, the stories that you see are about the conditions that domestic workers face. And that's a significant difference because of the organizing that's been happening across the country over the last decade. And I want to say that the campaign for the Bill of Rights wasn't just a policy campaign, it was an organizing campaign with the intention of mobilizing a broad cross-sector of people. So we have always been intentional about including employers, because at the end of the day, we recognize that while this is an employment relationship, it's also a unique employment relationship because of the bonds that are formed between the workers and the families that they care for. It's an intimate relationship that has been, it's certainly in a lot of ways, it's the source of the lack of clarity, the lack of boundaries, and the fact and why we actually need to always affirm and reinforce the fact that this is an employment relationship at the end of the day, which is why we need the standards. But certainly to lift up the fact that it's in everyone's interest to have standards. As much as it is for the workers, it's also in the best interest of the employer to have standards and clear terms of employment and expectations. There was a couple of things I also wanted to add. The messages were also structured in such a way that they were broad enough that everybody could identify with the fact that the work that makes all other work possible needs to be respected and protected. If domestic workers don't show up to work, their employers can't go to Wall Street, can't go to the hospital, they can't go and do their work in this global city. Educating the public about the history of exclusion. Domestic workers were intentionally excluded by name from the State Labor Relations Act in the United States. Educating people about that history. And then the last couple of things that I wanted to say about maximizing every single opportunity to mobilize people. Has anyone heard of this box office hit, The Help? Or heard of the best-selling book, The Help? We have utilized that opportunity. We created a short film to talk about the reality of today's help. We held rallies across the country to shed light again on the reality of today's help, that conditions haven't changed significantly since 1960s Mississippi. We have used that the spotlight that's right now shining on domestic work to push the California Bill of Rights and to try to mobilize as many people as possible and engage people in a public dialogue about domestic worker rights. So public opinion, while we're still, there's still a lot of work to do, and the struggle is long. We've come a long way in the last decade because of the organizing that's taken place, because of the courage and the bravery of domestic workers to come out and break the silence and demand to be seen, to be valued, and to be protected and recognized under the law.
Also created our own theater piece, original theater pieces, both DWU and Adhikar. We've done that also. That was created and acted by domestic workers to tell the stories, to tell their realities, and to engage an audience that we might not otherwise reach.
Well, I'd like to just... Oh, one more question. Okay.
My name is Saeed Hassan. Luna, can you compare and contrast the domestic worker in America and Nepal? First question. And or in Bangladesh or South Asians in general. How many countries ratify the convention so far? And the other questions I forgot.
Well, the second question first is that so far no country has ratified it yet, but Barbados recently said that they want to be the first to ratify, and Brazil is also working towards ratifying it. So, and once two countries ratify, it comes into effect.
Let me just add, in terms of the fact that no country has ratified it yet, that's not a bad sign. Mm-hmm. It is such a new convention that it actually wouldn't be feasible yet for any country to have ratified it. So the real test of whether there are a large number of countries ratifying it, we'll actually know in a couple of years how well it's doing compared to other treaties. But so far, just the participation in the process of coming together with this convention, the International Labour Organization said that it had the most government involvement in this process than it has in any other standard in the last 15 years.
And also through the International Domestic Workers Network, we're actively planning ratification campaigns in different parts of the world also. And I mean, in terms of comparing South Asia and domestic workers here, I guess domestic work is not as prevalent here as it is in South Asia, and I guess child workers are definitely much less, we're much less likely to encounter child workers here, but in terms of the power imbalance, the abuse that happens, it's unfortunate, but it is very, very similar. Often it's like different names, different faces, but where we are and what ethnicity we are does not seem to really matter, because it's, as Nisha was saying earlier as well, it's just so much power imbalance that happens here. And even like with child labor, actually, we are suing a former Indian diplomat here for bringing a 17-year-old to work as a domestic worker and not paying her for 3.5 years of work and counting bread so that she doesn't steal it. So it's happening, and this happened in the east side of Manhattan. So this is happening here also, and this just that the vulnerability of domestic workers working in isolation and working, and that, to be told, especially with migrant workers, and unfortunately, also the diplomats seem to be the worst offenders. They have the provision to bring domestic workers from their home countries, and these domestic workers are often, this is the first time they have come to the U.S. They don't know the language, they don't know anyone, they don't have a support system, and they're told, if you step out, if you talk to the police, they'll take you. The domestic worker, I remember mentioned, is told that she will be sent home in a cargo. Imagine living like that. But luckily she finally had enough and got the courage and left. And so, the legal fight is going to be a long one. But it is these things. And day after day, we hear a lot of stories about exploitation and abuse. But also, the good thing is that we are organizing here. We are organizing domestic workers here. And domestic workers are also organizing in Nepal, in India, in South Asia. There are domestic worker unions in South Asia that we still don't have here. And quickly to the last question of, like, you know, regardless of immigration status, laws protect all workers. It's once you have been hired and made to do work, immigration status cannot be used. And fortunately, although immigration system is broken, at least there is at least that much legal protection.
So, for example, in Singapore, what's the difference in the access to redress for a worker who has immigration status or who's in a irregular status?
Okay. I mentioned about the work permit, all right, which is the visa that you know, that any migrant worker that's working in the low wage jobs are required to have in terms of having a legal status in Singapore. The Employment of Foreign Manpower Act basically spells out the rights, privileges, as well as obligation of a holder of this work permit. All right. The thing is, for a domestic worker or any migrant worker, it actually has equal. They have equal status in terms of, you know, lodging a complaint with the Ministry of Labour if they have some problems or issues with their employees, for example, unpaid wages, and this is also opened to local workers. Because domestic workers are actually not covered under the Employment Act, all right, that means that the complaint will be investigated and it will be mediated by the labour officer. So it will never, and the outcomes of the mediation is the final outcome. So the domestic worker does not actually have a choice to take this up to the labour tribunal if they are not satisfied with the outcome of the mediation. Another thing I wish to mention also is that because the employer has unilateral right to cancel the work permit of a worker, and this applies to other migrant workers as well. So if a domestic worker complains, so for example, it's often used as a threat by employer to prevent migrant workers and domestic workers from actually lodging in complaints to the authorities if they have not been treated rightly. So that's the whole situation with the visa. And another requirement of the visa, which I find that has become a huge stumbling block for employers to be more accepting of domestic workers having a day off, is that they are required to secure a $5,000 as a security bond to the government. And the requirement of this security bond is that they are responsible to educate the workers of what they should not do in Singapore, which includes not, you know, of course, fair enough, you know, to be involved in criminal activities and all that sort of stuff. But what we are definitely against is that migrant workers are also not allowed to be involved in any activities that can be deemed as breaking up the Singaporean family. So, which is a very broad term. We don't know what that means. So we have seen domestic workers being banned from coming back into the country, for example, for having relationship with another male member of the employer family. I mean, you know, we're not talking about an illicit relationship where it's an affair, but it could just be another single male family member of the family. But if the employer, you know, is against that, then they actually have a right to complain to the Ministry of Labour, and the domestic worker will actually be put on a blacklist for that sort of stuff. Another thing is domestic workers are not allowed to be pregnant, to also marry a Singapore citizen or a permanent resident of Singapore while working in Singapore. So these are the things that employers, you know, view as, oh, they cannot have a day off. If they have a day off, these are the very things that they're going to get up to with all the free time that they have, that is, you know, that it's not outside our supervision, and what's going to happen, and we're going to have to be held responsible for this. Even though the terms of the security bond have actually been revised, it used to be that if the domestic worker falls pregnant, the employer will be penalized for it. But now it's that they just have to prove to the ministry that they have actually educated the worker of these terms, you know, which actually means that, you know, I have actually shown her but it's still, you know, deeply entrenched that, you know, I will lose my security bond if this should happen to my worker. So these are some of those immigration requirements that I find, you know, prohibitive in terms of actually, you know, championing for domestic workers to actually have equal access to the law. Yep.
But employers here also do use immigration status as a threat, though, even though workers have rights. Often workers don't know about it, and therefore employers end up using it as like to threaten them from complaining or asking for better work conditions also.
Just an opportunity for all of you to say anything more before we wrap up. 1 minute last. Oh, one more question. Sorry.
I would like to applaud Ms. Rahman and maybe many of others of you who have used art to engage with the public. And I actually work with a photographer who's done a project on domestic slavery. And what's interesting is that he is a photographer, and he photographed some of the places where domestic slavery took place in and around Paris, which is, again, a city where we think, you know, civilized and we don't do those kinds of things. He's made this project available online, both in English and in French. It's under www.domesticslavery.com. And it's in French also, esclavagedomestique.com or .fr. And it's free for everyone to use. So if anyone here who's involved thinks that it would be great to put up at a fundraiser at, I don't know, any kind of in the legal field or anywhere, you can download it. I'd be happy to contact him for more of the catalogs. It's basically kind of a booklet which is also used as an installation. And he's installed these in various places around the world. It was also displayed at the European Central Bank. He won an award. So it's just one way to get out and engage the public. And I have to say, it's the text is small, so you really have people engage with it because they're reading it and they don't really know what they're reading, and then they look at the picture. And what's so wonderful is it's one's imagination. You're not looking at a victim of domestic slavery. You're thinking about where, you know, where they could be if it's a neighbor, and it just makes one more aware. So.
Thank you.
Sorry, could I just add that this is interesting because there is actually a group in Singapore called Migrant Voices, which was established by a group of young people, which is great. So basically what it does is it's a platform for migrant workers to express themselves through art. So, and they also marry advocacy in their performances. So for example, they've had a series of forum theatre where it was actually acted out by migrant workers, domestic workers included, and they go out into the residential estates and they act out certain skits, and whereby then it opens up to the audience as a forum where they can intervene and you know, determine the outcomes of the actions or the behaviors or the play and things like that. So that was great, and they've also have continuing, you know, photo exhibition, which actually it's called the Inside Out Project, which had the history of that photo exhibition that I was telling you about earlier on. And it's basically is a project that gives the camera to the migrant workers to photograph the city and people and whatever through their eyes. And it's again a sort of another platform for them to express themselves and to also portray, you know, an alternative identity to what most Singaporeans perceive them as, just low-wage migrant workers in the country.
So last, very brief, anything that you want to leave people with?
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I hope we'll be able to continue these conversations. You know, if you're new to this issue, I would suggest that you learn more about it and talk to other people who may not. And even if you're not new to the issues, like, please talk to others who who may not know about this, so that we can have a widespread awareness about what happens in the domestic industry and we can make things better.
Okay, I'd just like to thank all of you again for your patience, for listening to all of us. Our organization can be found online. Google, just key in twc2.org.sg. You can find us there. We are in the process of revamping our website so that it becomes, more effective. But if you need, my contact is there. So if you are interested to find out more about Singapore, or if you're coming in through for research or whatever, please feel free to contact our organization or myself. Thank you.
So thank you all for coming.